This week on Lunchbox Envy. In 2001, Pizza Hut spent $1 million on a single pizza delivery.
Heston Blumenthal developed a bacon sandwich that could last up to 18 months.
But it all started with some meat paste squeezed out of a toothpaste tube.
It's space food. Hello and welcome to Lunchbox Envy. I'm Alex and I'm here with my fellow QI elves, Jack and Manu. Hello, Jack. Hello, Manu.
Hello.
How's it going?
Great, thanks. It's nice to be here, or rather not be here. We're doing another remote recording, aren't we?
We are, and that is because today we are talking about eating and drinking in space. And so we're not remote because one of us is in space, but we do have a very special guest joining us, food scientist and former manager of food systems at NASA for the Space Shuttle program and the International Space Station, Vicky Claris. Welcome, Vicky. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Do you want to tell us a bit about what you did for NASA over your many, many years there?
So I managed the operational portion of the food system. So I worked to get all the funding that we needed to produce and package the food. I worked with the contractor. I worked with the cargo people to get the shipping space that we needed to get food to orbit. I worked with the crew members to get their preferences for their menus. A little over 30 years, I managed first shuttle and then ISS. Yeah. I started there in 1985 as a contractor to help develop the frozen food system that we were going to have for Space Station Freedom, which was going to be a U.S.-only space station.
Okay. Of course it was, with a name like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It quickly became apparent that we were not going to have enough money to have an independent U.S.-only space station. And so it pretty quickly morphed into the International Space Station.
Just to kind of place this generally for people who aren't super familiar with the space program, if we divide up NASA by the programs, the main projects, you've got, starts off in 1958 with the Mercury project, which is the first human spaceflight program that basically they sent people up just to prove that they could survive. Then there was the Gemini program in 61 to 66, which practiced things like spacewalking and kind of, you know, docking. And all this was really in preparation for the big famous one, the Apollo program, which was 1961 to 1972, the project that took humans to the moon. After that was Skylab, which I feel like we never talk about Skylab enough. It's the funniest, weirdest, unsexiest one of all, I think, of the projects.
Sounds like a James Bond film as well.
It really does. But that was 1973 to 79, that was the first US space station. And it was literally like a sort of big tin can, very 70s, cladded with wood on the inside. It's kind of hilarious.
And yet it had the most sophisticated food system that NASA has ever flown into space.
Really?
Yeah.
Then came along the Space Shuttle program. And that was from the beginning of the 80s and only finished in 2011, I think. And then you've got, finally, the International Space Station, which is from the 90s and is still going strong.
The earliest space food. So the first examples I found, obviously, before we started sending humans into space, we loved sending animals into space just to check that it was safe. And one of the things I love is, so the Soviets sent the dogs Belka and Strelka in 1960 into orbit. And they survived. And what they ate aboard their flight was kind of meat in gelatin, which would be released automatically from bowls under their seats. And then when they finally sent Yuri up in 1961, so Yuri Gagarin, he ate something that wasn't dissimilar. So he was doing a very quick flight. It took about an hour and 48 minutes. And he bought two snacks. One was also like a gelatinous kind of tubey meat pate thing,
like
in
dog
a toothpaste
food.
Tube. Exactly. So pretty similar. And then he had a sweet snack, which was a chocolate sauce, also in a tube.
In a tube.
Do you think he did them both at the same time?
Oh, I hope not. Chocolate.
There's no one up there to judge, you know.
But then when the first American went into orbit, John Glenn, in 1962, he also took up a tube of food, but his was applesauce. So I feel like the very early snacks that we sent up into space are all quite like squishy and chewy and toothpastey.
And everything was dog food. Everything they describe, I'm like, this is just dog food.
Meat porridge.
Aren't they still quite terrified of crumbs? Like the food that they eat up there now, it still can't be like too crumbly or like bitty because it can get stuck in equipment. Is that right, Vicky?
Well, it's that, but it also can get in their eyes and they can breathe it into their lungs. So it can be a real hazard. And I can remember when Pringles first came out in a can, we had what was called the fresh food locker. It was supposed to be for fresh food, apples, oranges, things that would last a while. But then they also always wanted to take like their favorite cookie or something that wasn't part of the menu. So they turned it into a preference container, really. And so crew members wanted to take Pringles. We didn't forbid them. We just cautioned them. But after a couple of them had taken it, they came back and said, oh, we should have listened to you. That was a big mess. When we chose a commercial cracker or a cookie, we would choose bite size so that they could put it in their mouths all at once and they didn't have to bite into and make a lot of crumbs. So there was always these little things you had to think about, you know, when you were
putting
something together.
The amount of considerations you've got to think about.
What would your special food item be? Like, what would you have put in the locker?
Well, one of the first, when we started developing thermostabilized foods, that was the first product development we did for Space Station. We got our dietitian and all the food scientists around the table and said, where do we want to start? And believe it or not, where we wanted to start was dessert. And it was maybe not the healthiest place to start, but we all agreed from a psychological perspective, if I'm going to be on space station for 4 months, somewhere along the way, I'm going to want a dessert that I can warm up. And so we did a chocolate pudding cake in a pouch. And we did a cherry blueberry cobbler.
Ambitious, very ambitious, I would say, to crack into.
Cherry blueberry cobbler by far is one of my favorites and would be something I would put in my preference.
When it comes to sort of making space food, you've kind of, you've broadly got three categories. You've got thermostabilized foods, you've got rehydratable, and then you've got natural form. Is that right?
That's basically right. Yeah. So the natural form, that's cookies, crackers, nuts, candies. They call them natural form because they fly in their natural form. They don't further process them. All they do is package them. Thermostabilized is just like your canned products at home. It's ready to eat. You're not going to be adding any fluid to it. So it's already got the moisture in it. Rehydratable is what NASA calls freeze-dried. Because there's two categories there. There's freeze-dried food, and then there's powdered beverages. So rehydratable means that they've got to add water back to it.
Got it.
Yeah.
And that includes quote-unquote space ice cream, which we actually did on the podcast months and months ago. But I don't think it's ever been to space.
It's been to space, yes. So it's gone on shuttle flights for sure. But to be honest, it appeals more to kids than it does to adults.
It's kind of horrible.
And it's designed to be eaten dry. And none of the freeze-dried stuff that we send is designed to be eaten dry. It's designed to have water added to it
before we tried it. It was incredibly crumbly, and my first thought was, this is not suitable for a microgravity environment.
I read that it was designed for the gift shop, not to send out.
Yeah, it really
because
was.
It doesn't make any sense.
It really was. And you find it in every NASA gift shop and museum.
So that's the final category: is fake space food. Would you say there's maybe a fourth? Would you say there's maybe a fourth category of fresh food, like, you know, apples that go up at the beginning of the mission because they can last a couple of days going up?
Yeah. So on shuttle, we, like I said, we had the fresh food locker. With space station, depending on how late they can access the cargo vehicle prior to launch, they will put some stuff like apples, oranges, things like that on there. And they can even put some things like hard cheeses that don't have a big moisture content, so they're not going to mold as fast or anything.
The absolute nightmare is that they do it and then there's like a 3-week launch delay, and then they get up there and the astronauts open it and there's just all this like moldy fruit and
and then the French astronaut in the corner is like, lovely.
That has happened before, where, you know, it wasn't quite so good when it got there, but occasionally occasionally, if you've got a cargo vehicle that's going to come back, you know, like the SpaceX cargo vehicle comes back, it might have a freezer on the uphill trip because they're going to bring back medical samples that are frozen on orbit, right? And so if it's empty on the uphill trip and it's got power, then you're going to see ice cream and stuff go
real
up
ice cream,
to the,
not space ice cream.
Yeah, things like Dove Bites and, you know, little individual small servings of ice cream. Anytime fresh food or ice cream or something like that gets there, it's like Christmas for those folks, you know. It's a big party.
Yeah.
The way that you're preparing food on Earth means that surely the weight of it is way, way less than it would be because you're removing so much excess water.
Well, weight is less on the freeze-dried and the powdered beverages because they're adding the water on orbit. But then, you know, there's a big chunk of the food system that weighs what it weighs. I mean, you know, the cookies, the crackers, the candy, the pouch stuff.
Are you ever trying to sell them like candy floss and popcorn and really lightweight stuff that takes up loads of space to have an aero? It's full of air bubbles. The polos, they've got a hole in the middle. Starting off this week with our first lunchbox, and that is mine. And this week I have brought a zero gravity cup. It kind of looks a bit like a sippy cup, but also like a jug, literally designed to be a cup that doesn't have to be a pouch. It doesn't have to have a lid in it. It doesn't have to have a straw in it. It's an open cup that you can keep a liquid in and drink out of it. But you can do that in zero gravity because obviously you cannot do that with a regular cup because the liquid goes everywhere. I love it because it's designed to be something so simple and yet so much science and work has had to go into it. It uses surface tension to hold a liquid pretty much inside and then sort of draw it out towards
I can start by saying it does exist, and there have been a couple of different versions of it. But the one that I've seen, basically, it kind of has spirals in the wall. Mm-hmm. And so the fluid comes from the lowest reservoir, and it kind of gets siphoned up. It's like it's going through a little tunnel to get to the top. But actually, NASA doesn't use it. NASA still uses, and the Russians do too, pouches that they're drinking out of with straws. So
I guess
they're
the
not
old ways
used...
are the best. Yeah.
It's going to say, has
if it ain't broke, don't fix it, as they say. The biggest problem with a reusable cup is how do you clean it? That would be the biggest problem with incorporating it into the everyday. Yeah, is how do you clean it?
So I thought we could kick things off by talking about drinks in space and drinking. And in fact, I think maybe that was the first thing consumed on the moon.
Buzz Aldrin's Holy Communion on the Moon, which wasn't widely publicized, but we've already mentioned in our wine episode that Buzz Aldrin took communion on the moon. So one of the first things that was ever consumed on the moon was wine and the little wafer.
But I think, wasn't it the wrong kind of wine? I remember when he came on the QI's radio show, he said that somebody packed white wine instead of red wine.
That's news to me. I had not heard that
one. Well, I'd never heard it anywhere else either. It's just that Buzz Aldrin himself said it.
And it never made it, but they did giving the astronauts sherry.
Over the years, I saw some samples of kind of their prototypes that they had in storage there. Yeah.
But there isn't alcohol up there, and there are... Okay, but, what is that face, Vicky?
So when we started working with the Russians, we had heard all along that the Russians had alcohol on Mir. This is when we were before ISS, right?
Which was their space station.
Sure. And so we asked about it. Like we asked the flight surgeons that we were working with on the Russian team, and they were like, nyet, nyet. You know, they denied that it was there. But I can remember, and to this day, I have a copy of the picture, when Shannon Lucid was on Mir, she was one of the U.S. astronauts that went and stayed on Mir. And there's this picture that she took, the gal belly in the Russian service module. But if you look closely in the corner, you can see the butt of three glass bottles. There's no doubt that it's alcohol bottles sitting there on the shelf.
I thought you were going to say the butt of a drunken cosmonaut who was passed out.
No, just the bottle. So it was kind of interesting. When we transitioned into space station, when the crews got bigger, it got to the point where they could not launch enough water to support that size of crew. So they had to start recycling water. Even urine, everything was being recycled. And so once they started recycling, ethanol became a problem because it gets into the recycling system and it's a pollutant. It cannot be broken down.
Right.
At the time, of course, there's no dishwasher, no sink to wash your utensils. So we were using wipes and they would wipe off the utensils between meals. Mm. And we were using an ethanol-based wipe. And when they got ready to start recycling, they called this big meeting and everybody said, we've got to do something about this because we can't have all this ethanol in the air.
Astronauts having a great time up there, I guess. Yeah. Party.
Which one of these moons?
We easily switched to another wipe that didn't contain ethanol. I'll never forget in this meeting, we're all sitting there and they're showing data from the air monitoring. And every time the Russian cargo vehicle would dock, you would see this spike.
No.
That's so good.
They're doing lots of cleaning.
They were just cleaning everything, Vicky. Come on.
Yeah. Nobody said anything, but everybody knew exactly what that meant.
I read that in the 70s, the sort of early years of space travel, the Soviets were like, you're not really allowed to bring booze, but they were like, well, we're going to anyway, it's culturally important. And I think they got a lot of doctor's exemptions, but they also suggested that they'd lose weight so that they could hide it in their suits.
so you mean they would get weighed?
Yeah, they'd be like, oh, you're 80 kilos. And then they just try and lose like 250 grams so they could bring some vodka.
Wow.
Apparently in the 1990s, I read a report from a cosmonaut in 93, and he said that they'd always just, once they fancied a little bit of booze, they just check inside some of the panels just to see if there's like a previous
last watch had left
mission.
I was looking into carbonation because I was interested in beer and the wine, and then I was looking at Tang, which was the orange drink that famously the Apollo astronauts drank, and it was sort of adopted by NASA as the official drink, which I always thought was carbonated, but it wasn't. It's like flat Fanta, basically. And I realized that actually carbonated drinks are a nightmare in space, because a big part of when you open a can and it all fizzes is if you have a carbonated drink in circumstances of gravity.
The CO2 floats.
Because the CO2 is less dense than the liquid, it all gets pushed up to the top and most of it disappears quite quickly.
So the problem is, if you had Coke in an unpressurized container, you would have the beverage in one place and the carbonation in another. It doesn't stay interspersed like it would in gravity. Shortly after I came to work there, Coca-Cola wanted to fly Coke into space. But in order to do that and have it work in microgravity, they had to develop a special can, because if it wasn't pressurized, then the carbonation would separate from the beverage, so it just would not taste the same. Yeah, very sophisticated looking. In fact, they have it in the Coca-Cola Museum in Atlanta. And it was a one-shot deal. It was a PR thing, right? Mm. And when Coca-Cola got ready to fly it, it became this big political deal, because Pepsi stepped forward and said, you can't do this without us. And it went all the way to the White House.
Really?
And, made a big deal about the fact that they needed to fly too. They both flew on the shuttle, and they made a big deal of sampling them and all that. But I can remember the crew members saying, so, okay, we had hot Coke and hot Pepsi. What's the big deal?
Oh,
because they had no way to chill it.
I think they got their pictures and they got their headlines and they got their millions of pounds of marketing.
Right. and the truth of the matter is, in microgravity, you would not want to have a lot of carbonation.
Wet burps.
You got it right there.
What's wet burps? Do I want to know what wet burps is?
In microgravity, when you burp, more than likely, it's not going to be a dry burp like you'd have down here. You're going to have some of the fluid or some of the food come with it. If you've ever had a wet burp, it is like the most unpleasant thing in the world. So you're not going to want a lot of carbonation in your diet in microgravity.
And apparently, in 2015, the International Space Station got a proper espresso machine built by Lavazza and the Italian Space Agency.
Oh, yeah. And so it went up basically as an experiment on the payload. Side. As I recall, it used the Nespresso capsules like you can buy in the store.
But which ones is the question? Because you don't want to send up the wrong shape and then find out you can't use it, which I always do. I always buy the wrong ones in the shop and then I can't use them.
One of the Italian astronauts who flew later,
yeah,
the thing quit working. And he was determined that he was going to spend some time while he was up there trying to get it going again. And so we sent the supplies for him to do that, but he was not successful.
Oh.
Apparently that's why they built it, because one of the Italian astronauts called Luca Parmitano,
he
complained so much about how bad the coffee was. He was like, I need a proper Italian coffee, and that's why they sent it up. So it was Lavazza and then an engineering company called Argotech, and they built this thing so that it was like incredibly safe, because it's a lot of pressure. Mm-hmm. In order for an Italian coffee to be like an Italian espresso, the Italian National Espresso Institute says that it needs to be passed through like 9 bars of pressure. The one that they sent up could withstand 400 bar pressure.
How many coffees are they planning to make? What? 400?
I think it just needed to be super, super safe. But the machine weighed 20 kilograms. So this is a really pretty intense piece of kit. It's called the Espresso, the ISSpresso.
ISSpresso. Yeah, that's right.
I gotta say, like, 10 out of 10 NASA for customer service. Like, you know, you're an astronaut complains that you can't get a good cup of coffee, and you spend how much money and get like out to get him a good cup of coffee? That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
That was the Italian Space Agency doing that. NASA would not have done that. I'm pretty sure.
All right, time to move on to our second lunchbox, and that is Manu. What have you got for us, Manu?
Today, I have brought Velcro.
Oh, that's not very edible, Manu.
It's not edible, but without it, I feel like eating in space would not be possible.
Ah.
Every single video I have watched from the space station, everything, it's got like a strip of Velcro on it to make sure it doesn't float away.
Oh, cool.
So like all of the sauces, all of their cutlery, all of the food packets.
Yeah, Velcro is pretty important part. And you know, bungee cords help too sometimes.
Yes. Yeah. That reminds me, going back to Skylab, I saw a cool picture of a meal tray with separated sections. It was pretty deep. It was sort of, you know, several inches deep. And the idea was that it had different compartments for your food that you ate out of it, like a TV dinner tray, but it also heated the different meals, which is pretty epic. Wow.
So for Skylab, because they had the frozen food, they wanted the packages to be able to fit directly in the warmer so that they could heat it up more quickly. So that tray that you saw, those front three compartments on that tray, the circular holes, they had switches on the front.
Mm.
And so if you put a frozen item in there, you flip the switch and it heated it up.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's so low effort for like people who don't want to cook. You just literally sit in front of the TV with your tray and just flip the switch and it cooks in front of you.
What they had was a pedestal that had three of those trays mounted on the top of that pedestal. So that, you know, they would restrain themselves next to the dining table.
That was their dining table, basically, their floating dining table.
Yeah, that was their dining table.
It's kind of like in Mary Poppins when they're all floating around at that table.
That was very, very elaborate tray, yeah.
I do think a part of it is trying to keep things comfortable and homely. And I'm sure you spent lots of time thinking about the nutritional value and the practicalities of getting setting all this stuff up, but culturally and socially, it's quite important, right, for people to enjoy what they're eating and drinking up there and, you know, having meal times and stuff like that.
So the whole psychology of dining in space really didn't exist that much during the shuttle program. I mean, most people did not care that much about food because the missions were so short. The longest ones were maybe 17 days at the most, you know. On shuttle, when the food became more important was if they were up for a holiday, you know, if they were up at Christmas time or they were up at Thanksgiving time or whatever, then we would use the fresh food locker to provide special stuff for the holiday meal. And on shuttle, we had a 100% personal preference menu. So they would come in, they would try the food, they would choose what they wanted for each meal for the duration of the flight. So if it was a 10-day flight, some crew members chose 10 different menus. But we had one interesting crew member who chose one menu and repeated it throughout.
Oh my God, what did they have?
He loved our shrimp cocktail. So he had shrimp cocktail at breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
I've read about this. This keeps coming up. Whoa. Everyone loves the shrimp cocktail. Chris Hadfield said how much he loved the shrimp cocktail. Really? It was his favorite. Yeah.
Shrimp cocktail was historically one of our more popular items. It was especially popular on shuttle. It was freeze-dried shrimp with a powdered tomato-based sauce, but it had horseradish in there. So it had a nice kick. And most everybody, even now, is very popular on station as well. And I can remember Peggy Whitson, who now works for Axiom. She didn't like the shrimp cocktail. But when she would fly to ISS, she would take it in her preference because she would use it to bribe other crew
members. Bartering. Oh, amazing.
Genius. Yeah,
that's very foresightful.
So clever.
So she bartered with the shrimp cocktail. But the importance of the psychology of dining really didn't show up until Space Station. When we went into Space Station, we tried to maintain that personal preference menu, and it did not work. Because on shuttle, the food and the crew member were on the same vehicle. They never got separated. When we went into ISS, most of the food was now going up on unmanned cargo vehicles. The crew members would come back and complain and say, "You promised me I was going to get what I selected. And part of the time I had to eat Joe Blow's food because mine wasn't there yet. And that person had terrible taste in food." Mm. So it became this big issue, this big psychological issue, you know. I was supposed to get what I ordered.
I didn't get what I ordered. I can't believe that's still a problem in space.
Yeah. And so we developed this standard menu, but the deal we made was that we would augment that with a smaller amount of preference food for them.
Okay, so you get to pick a little bit, but then mostly
you get to
just
pick a little bit. We started using the standard menu on Expedition 16, and we're what, on 73 or 74 now? I lose track, to be honest. Oh, yeah. It's been tweaked over the years, but it's still what they're using.
The set menu.
And the other accommodation that we made is that it's packed pantry style. So like all the meats are together, all the veggies are together. And so when they go to eat, even though it's a standard menu, they're not eating per menu. They're going and selecting what they want.
Mix and match.
So it's mix and match. They don't even have to eat the same thing. Yeah.
You can have beef paste and chocolate.
Yeah, that's right.
It's like a garden.
Another thing about the bits of the menu that they get to decide outside of the standard menu. One of the astronauts who's going to go up this year is from the ESA, so the European Space Agency, and her name is Sophie Audneau. She's French, and she has gotten a chef called Anne-Sophie Pick to design her special menu. And Anne-Sophie Pick,
she's the most Michelin-starred
chef. Like, she's from a dynasty of French gastronomists. And I've got her menu here.
It's peak French, isn't it?
It's so French. So for starters, she's got foie gras cream on toasted brioche with candied lemon, lobster bisque, all of these incredible like veloutés, onion soup, main course, shredded braised beef with black garlic and smoked vanilla, and then poultry, and then her dessert, which also sounds so beautiful, coconut and smoked vanilla rice pudding.
Wow.
And then chocolate cream with hazelnut flour and coffee.
Oh my gosh.
And it's just the most French thing.
I'm trying to gauge Vicky's reaction to that. Well, what are your thoughts on this insane menu?
My thoughts would be I would love to know how they're preserving it.
I think I would trust NASA, who's been developing it for those years, over I'm sure a wonderful Michelin star chef, but who's never cooked for space before. I'm just very skeptical, I have to say. Sorry,
so we did stuff with Emeril Lagasse. NASA headquarters did a PR thing with him where they wanted to fly some of his products, and so he picked out some recipes, sent them to us, so we chose the ones that we thought would freeze dry the best. When we would develop a new product, you're going to have to do iterations and adjust the formulation and all this stuff, multiple tries to where we could get it the highest quality possible. Mm. When we did the stuff for Emeril Lagasse, we got one shot at it. It was freeze dried. It was sent to orbit. The crew members ate it. They actually did a down broadcast to his show or whatever. And, you know, I know they acted like it was the best tasting stuff in the world, but I seriously doubt it tasted very much like the original at all.
They're in showbiz. They know what they're doing.
Yeah.
It was interesting, even today on the International Space Station, the reason that, say, food isn't really cooked up there. I assumed this was mostly for safety reasons, right, or practicality reasons, but I didn't realize that also on a scientific level, so many of these processes really rely on convection, which is a type of heat transfer which doesn't really work in microgravity environments. So, for example, when you're boiling, when you've got a bubbling pan of water, the bubbles don't rise in the same way that they don't in a can of like fizzy drink. And steaming and simmering all have circulation patterns, how the liquid moves around when you're boiling it, and those don't happen either. I think maybe baking a cake is the hardest thing you could possibly do in space, because for starters, like, baking doesn't work. Secondly, every single ingredient is basically dust, so you would probably kill yourself by inhaling all the flour or something before you finished. But even yeast doesn't grow properly in microgravity environments, so you wouldn't be able to like get your cake to rise. I think on the most basic molecular level, space is not designed for cooking. It's quite sad.
Well, probably cooking's not designed for space.
Okay, time now for our final lunchbox, and that is from Jack.
Yeah, so I have brought some air.
Oh my God, these are the most disappointing lunchboxes today. Why have you brought air?
So I wanted to talk about the future of space food, because the main thing on the horizon is long distance space travel. So for instance, if you were spending more than 100 days, like up to a year, even if we went to Mars, that would be a 3-year mission at least. So scientists at the European Space Agency have developed the rather crowbarred acronym Project HOBI-1, HOBI-WAN, a la Obi-Wan Kenobi. And it stands for the Hydrogen Oxidizing Bacteria in Weightlessness. And then AS is the A. And then a source of, which doesn't really count. And then nutrition. So you can see why it's a bit convoluted. But basically, it's a collaboration between the Finnish food producer and the European Space Agency, and it involves growing microbes en masse, which basically feed off hydrogen, oxygen, and CO2, which you can get from the recyclers in space. And then they've managed to get nitrogen from our urine, and these bacteria then convert this into a protein powder.
This is Huel.
Doesn't that sound appetizing?
But yeah, I mean, it's been marketed as from air, but actually, you know, it's coming from our breath and the moisture and some of our waste products, to be honest. But
that's amazing. What an amazing idea, though.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I can remember we had so many times that people would contact me during my career and say, we're producing this algae, this edible algae, you know, you need to fly this on the shuttle. And I'm like, I could put it on there, but I can't make them eat it. You got to have some seriously dedicated people that are going to want to eat protein powder from urine. Actually, the food that we currently fly is safe for going to Mars. We could make food that would last long enough. But the challenge is, you can stop the microbial changes, but you can't stop the chemical changes that occur in that food over time. So what happens is The flavor degrades, the color degrades, the texture degrades.
And then you lose your Michelin star, and then it's all downhill from that.
So the first mission to Mars, you're probably going to be sending shelf-stable food. I'm sorry, but you can't really depend on a refrigerator or a freezer, because if it goes out, you're screwed, you know? Yeah.
There's one thing we've learned on this podcast is that the Vicky trusts shelf-stable food over everything else.
You know, the challenge is, how do you keep the quality high enough and the nutritional content high enough for a 3-year mission round trip so that the crew members are going to be eating enough to thrive and not just enough to survive?
It's cool to know that we actually do have the technology if we wanted to go today. I love the kind of sci-fi spaceship with a greenhouse in it where you can grow these green plants and things like that.
And that's what they need to be working on. And part of the reason they want to have a habitat on the moon is to be able to try out those kind of technologies that they're going to need for a Mars mission. You're not going to have that infrastructure on a first mission to Mars. That's the problem. You might have it down the road, but you're probably not going to have it on the initial mission.
That's one, mate.
So NASA's done a lot of work with growing plants. Most of that work is done in Florida now. They did do some in Houston during my career. We did chamber studies where they had plants providing part of the oxygen for crew in a chamber.
Cool.
And I actually participated as a crew member in a 91-day test.
Wow.
So this was in 96. We were testing air and water recycling systems.
Oh, my gosh.
And so we were in the chamber for 91 days.
And what did the chamber look like? Sorry, how big was it? Can you describe it?
It was probably about 40 feet in diameter. It was left over from Skylab. It was at the Johnson Space Center.
Oh, my God, it was left over from Skylab.
Friend of the podcast, Skylab.
To train the astronauts.
Right, yeah.
And it was three-level. And on the first level was where the shower was, the toilet was, and the small kitchen that we had, and a dining table. The second level, a lot of the air and water recycling equipment. And then the third level was divided in quarters where we slept.
And you were eating thermostabilized food?
We were eating mostly flight foods.
Wow. And what were your takeaways from that? Not takeaways. You didn't have any takeaways. I mean, like...
Just pizza.
Ruined the mission.
I mean, it was fascinating to be on that end of it, you know, and eating all that stuff. I had tasted all the stuff before, definitely.
But living
on it. We tasted
it
all the time. But living on it is a little bit different. Yeah. I was the science officer in the experiment, and we were doing about 13 different experiments while we were in the chamber. And so a lot of it was exercise related, trying to develop exercise protocols for the crew members on orbit. And I'm a microbiology major by training. And so we were doing surface sampling a lot, tracking how quickly microbes were going to build up in a station that's sitting up there for, you know, X number of years. We helped develop diet logs that they were going to use on station. But we did have a chamber where we grew lettuce. And you know, it was kind of the precursor to the veggie unit that they have on orbit now, where they grow stuff. And 1/4 of our oxygen was being supplied from another chamber that had 15,000 wheat plants in it. Yeah.
Wow. No way.
And we were providing CO2 to the wheat plants. Yeah.
Wow. Of course. Maybe to finish off, looking back at all the different meals and foods you provided, are there any meals or dishes that you never cracked that you always felt you wanted to get up there?
Oh, yeah, the Holy Grail.
Oh, well, I can remember when we first started talking about thermostabilized desserts, we wanted to do a cheesecake. And we never could make it work. I mean, we could make it taste good, but it looked horrible.
Oh, you just didn't look good enough. That's why you wouldn't send it.
Yeah.
That's a British Bake Off special we haven't seen yet. It's a space food special.
Space edition.
You send Mary Berry up into orbit and get her to cook a cake and see if she can deal with it. That is it for this week's edition of Lunchbox Envy.
You can follow our socials for foodie facts and podcast updates. We are on X, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok @LunchboxEnvyPod.
You can also get in touch and send us your facts, recipes and questions by emailing us lunchbox@qi.com.
Vicky, I actually haven't managed to get your book yet. Can you tell us a bit about it?
So it's called Space Bites, Reflections of a NASA Food Scientist. And it talks about the food system to some degree, but it also has a lot of anecdotes about my career. And it's available from ballastbooks.com, like a ship's ballast. Sure. And all my proceeds are going to scholarships for food science students.
Oh, amazing. Yeah. Vicky, thank you so much for joining us. It's been unbelievably informative. We will see you next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Lunchbox MV was hosted by Manu Onrio, Jack Chambers, and me, Alex Bell, with special guest Vicky Claris. This has been a quite interesting podcast.